The Irish Times leads today with the line that, following the move yesterday by the NTMA to withdraw Davies' ability to act as a primary dealer of Irish government bonds, the stockbroking firm closed its bond desk, resulting in 4 redundancies as it raced to contain the crisis triggered by the record central bank fine it received last week. The Irish Examiner reports in its front page, meanwhile, that all of the 16 employees who were involved in the rogue bond trade in 2014 have since left the company. The Irish Independent leads today with the line that CAO points are likely to be driven up this year by an increase in demand for college courses. Catherine Donnelly reports that Trinity College has seen a 38% increase in applications and that a so-called COVID effect is visible in the number of students opting for medical and other health science courses. The Oprah Winfrey interview with Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, which was broadcast on RTE television last night, generates the lead story in the Irish Daily Mail, Irish Daily Mirror and Irish Sun. Worst royal crisis in 85 years is the headline in the Mirror, while the Mail reports that the royal family was paralysed with horror and dismay last night as Prince Harry stood accused of blowing up his family with his bombshell interview. For its lead story, the Examiner reports that 111 cases of investment fraud amounting to more than €4 million in losses were reported last year. Gardaí believe, however, that the actual number could be tens of millions of euro since many people are too embarrassed to report the crime. Cormac O'Keefe reports that many of the recent crimes involve virtual frauds such as Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. The lack of a police presence at street celebrations in Belfast on Sunday night, when Rangers fans celebrated their team's victory in the Scottish League, is covered as the lead story in the Irish News. Why didn't police stop Rangers' COVID super spreader celebrations is a headline there. For its lead story, the Belfast Telegraph reports on criticisms of Stormont's plan to exit the current lockdown by Professor Gabriel Scally. Back in the front of the Times, it's reported there that Ireland is set to receive less than half the deliveries of COVID-19 vaccines it originally expected in the first 3 months of the year. We're also told that delivery dates for shipments of vaccines changed on more than 20 occasions in the last 2 months and that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is not expected to arrive here until mid-April. Over on the front of The Independent, meanwhile, it's reported that NPHET is expected to agree to start allowing visits to nursing homes as most residents and staff have now been vaccinated. And finally, Fintan O'Toole has a strongly worded piece in today's Times about the Davy employees who personally profited from the sale of Anglo-Irish bank bonds in 2014. Right at the time when our wounds were raw and still bleeding, these people stuck in the knife of greed and arrogance and unabashed entitlement. Even after everything that happened, they asserted their right to carry on regardless. We know all the costs of impunity, O'Toole writes. If these individuals get away with it, we deserve the consequences.
Extending protections for tenants struggling in the pandemic, formalising a 5-week parental leave, and with ministers grounded, the St Patrick's Day celebrations. Some of the items for consideration by the Cabinet later on today. Our political correspondent Micheál Lehan joins me with more. Micheál, Minister Dara O'Brien, the Housing Minister, to extend these rent protections for tenants. What's involved here?
Yeah, the rent protections at the moment come in two parts. One of them, which is the blanket ban on evictions, that is linked to the 5-kilometre limit, and that is due to expire within 10 days of that limit if it is changed. And of course, that's set to run until April 5th, but a review to take place by government in the lead up to it. But as well as that, if that does fall at some point in April, then there is another piece of legislation that does, a more targeted piece in one sense, that does allow protections for tenants if they find themselves in arrears, that if they make a self-declaration stating that their income has fallen as a result of the pandemic, that they do have protections from being evicted for a period, and also that they can't face any rent increases in that point as well. So that piece of legislation that was due to expire on April 12th, that now it's expected Cabinet this morning will extend that until July 12th, which offers tenants a form of protection at least until the second week in July.
Now, we also in the budget for 2021 had an announcement that parental leave would be extended from 2 weeks to 5 weeks. Will they move to give effect to that today?
Yeah, it seems that that is going to happen fairly soon now, possibly from the beginning of April. Cabinet will discuss it this morning. The Children's Minister, Roderick O'Gorman, bringing a memo before colleagues. That is going to increase from 2 weeks to 5 weeks. Of course, that's leave that would see a payment of €245 for each parent during that period. It is likely to benefit possibly up to 30,000 parents, and it is open to anyone who has had a child since November 2019. So it's a significant measure and something that has been spoken about since the government was formed. As well as that, there is an anomaly arising around adoptive leave that male same-sex couples haven't been able to avail of the full period of adoptive leave. That will also change in this particular memo and one other in this particular piece of legislation ultimately. And one other piece as well means that the parents' leave at the moment can only be taken within the first year of a child's life or the first year of when a child comes to a family in the case of an adoption. That now is going to be extended to 2 years, so it can be taken over a 2 year period. And it's interesting too that it is that piece of legislation, the Family Leave Bill, that the government will use to include amendments and bring before the Oireachtas fairly soon around the whole personal injuries question arising from decisions taken by the judiciary at the weekend. So that piece of legislation will combine two bits, changes to personal injuries guidelines, and also those changes to extend family leave and parents' leave.
Now, normally at this time of year, I'd be talking to you, Micheál, and to other political correspondents about where our ministers would be going for St. Patrick's Day. We all remember last year, of course, Leo Varadkar in Washington when he announced that lockdown. This year, though, it's going to have to be a St. Patrick's Day with a difference. And ministers grounded?
Yeah, ministers grounded. And of course, that decision, the big decision taken some time back about the Taoiseach not travelling to Washington. So today the cabinet will discuss what the government will do to try and get its message out there on Patrick's Day. And there will be contact by ministers to people across Europe and across the world as well. But one of the central strategies appear to be that the Irish embassies all around the world will hold virtual events with key contacts in each of their regions. And also there will be a major role for President Michael D. Higgins as well in sending out that message on St. Patrick's Day, an attempt by government to try and ensure that that contact built up over several decades is maintained virtually this year. Simon Coveney, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, to update colleagues on this morning, but he will attend the cabinet virtually following his recent return from Iran.
Two other issues, the mandatory hotel quarantining. Do you expect to sign off today on those contracts? And we will be talking about Davy later, but the central bank before the finance committee.
Yeah, I think the cabinet will be speaking about the mandatory quarantine system. It's expected that the health minister will informally, it seems, update colleagues on where that is at. The contract may not quite be signed today. It may be another day or two before that happens, but it will happen this week, ultimately then paving the way for the system. It's felt to be up and running possibly next week, and that you could see up to six hotels in the Greater Dublin area used for that. Some questions still that have to be dealt with there is how much will each person pay if they do have to spend the full term of 14 days in a hotel in quarantine. That's one of the things that has to be resolved. There's also likely to be a communications initiative through the weekend, letting everyone know that this new system is coming into place next week.
Micheál Lehan, our political correspondent, thank you very much. 19 minutes past seven.
To talk now about the COVID vaccine and its impact on pregnancy. Last night's NPHET briefing heard reassurances given to pregnant women about the effect that the jab has on them. In a moment, we will speak to the chair of the Institute of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. But first, here is consultant rheumatologist Dr. Laura Durkin, who got the vaccine last December. She spoke to us last night.
I am currently 37 weeks pregnant. I was lucky enough to be offered the vaccine kind of in the first rollout with healthcare professionals. And look, you know, it's always a personal decision based on kind of the risks and benefits. But for me, I was working in a high-risk environment. Loads of my colleagues had been unwell. I'd looked after quite a bit of COVID, and I'd seen lots of sick COVID, and you know, full insight into what an awful disease it can be. And I was very conscious that I wanted to be safe at work, that I wanted my baby to be safe while I continued to work, and I wanted to still be able to look after the children that I have at home. Now, I did lots of reading on the kind of mechanisms of the vaccine. I did lots of reading on the clinical trials. I suppose I went into it really making the best informed decision that I could make. And yeah, I had the vaccine, not a single side effect. It really was something that lifted the burden of worry from me about COVID once I was a couple of weeks out from that dose. And that has continued to be the case. So I was very happy with the decision that I made.
Dr. Laura Durkin there. Well, we are joined now by Dr. Cliona Murphy, who is chair of the Institute of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Dr. Murphy, you're very welcome to the programme. The vaccine wasn't trialled on pregnant women. So how do you know that it is safe?
So pregnant women weren't given the opportunity to become involved in the vaccine studies in the beginning. So that obviously is an issue. And we have less information on outcomes in pregnancy as regards safety and efficacy. We do know, that the trials themselves encompass quite a large number of people, so 20,000 in each arm. And we do know that a small number of women were included who didn't realise they were pregnant at the time. And we have not heard of adverse effects in these women, but they would be sort of 10 in the placebo arm and 11 in the active arm that was in the Pfizer trial. Since vaccination began in the US, there was a big movement really by the professional organisations, Society for Maternal Fetal Medicine, to say that, you cannot exclude pregnant women just because they're pregnant, and because we don't have as much information, they're at risk as well as their other non-pregnant healthcare workers. So it was opened up when there was no theoretical risk. There were no risks from animal studies identified. It's important to note that none of the manufacturers have said it's contraindicated in pregnancy, mm-hmm. which is different to some other medications, obviously. And since then, we in Ireland have quite a bit of information now since vaccination rolled out in the US, because of their population, a large number of these healthcare workers took the vaccine. At this point, about 30,000 have been vaccinated, and they have started collecting observational data. So there is a registry called the VSafe US registry, and they've started collecting data. And so far, there have been no adverse outcomes over and above what one would expect from the population.
Okay, so that worry that women may have about impacting the actual pregnancy, there's no reason to worry that getting the vaccine may end the pregnancy.
No, there's no increase in miscarriage or stillbirth in the groups who've had vaccination so far. Now, that's not to say we have all the information we would like to have. Obviously, it would have been better if there were women included in trials or they had more information. But, the reproductive studies in animals haven't shown any worries. Oh. We have no theoretical risk. So, the injection, there's no change to somebody's DNA. The way the vaccines work, they trick your body into developing an antibody to this horrible virus. And then when you are confronted with it later on, you have the tools to fight off the virus. And then there is probably a positive benefit to your baby, where these antibodies could be available to your baby later on. So yeah. That's a possible benefit.
And the other worry that women have, Dr. Murphy, is that it may cause infertility in later life. I mean, is there any evidence of that?
None whatsoever. I would like to be very clear about that. We know lots now about COVID and its horrible effects on, both short-term and long-term. And we know that older age are at more risk, but we've seen this occur in young people. There's no evidence at all that taking any of the vaccines affects a woman's future ability to conceive or to continue a pregnancy. And again, these studies done in animals haven't shown, and they have a shorter reproductive life than we have, haven't raised any concerns. And I really would like to get out there that we recommend all those of reproductive age take the COVID-19 vaccine as it becomes available. And obviously, yeah,
but that might be months away. Is your message this morning, it's more dangerous to get COVID than it absolutely is to get the vaccine and, for pregnant women.
And I suppose for those who maybe have, you know, special histories, you know, somebody who's a history of recurrent miscarriages or, you know, has had a difficult time before, again, for those, there's no reason to avoid the vaccine. And there's a lot of women in this country and couples in this country who would be planning for IVF. And for those, they could make the choice to wait to have both, you know, both shots. But for somebody planning now, if they haven't been offered the vaccine, go ahead and have the IVF. It is safe to commence IVF a few days after the second dose. So, you know, people don't have to wait a long time either.
Okay. And just a final question to you about the virus itself, the COVID-19 virus, mm-hmm. and infertility in men. Is there evidence to support any link there?
Well, we know in the past that any viral illness can affect fertility in men. It can affect the sperm quality. And we think that that's to do with getting sick and a temperature. And there are some small studies saying that there's a negative effect on fertility in men in that way, in men who've been quite sick with it. Now, we don't have, obviously, the long-term studies on that. And in men, you know, sperm quality can be bad 1 month and improve a few months after that. But again, I think it's another reason to welcome vaccination and not to run the risk of getting COVID.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Cliona Murphy, Chair of the Institute of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. It's 7:26.
The trial of a police officer accused of killing George Floyd, a black man in Minneapolis in May of last year, is due to get underway this morning with jury selection. Now, people will recall video footage showing Derek Chauvin, a white police officer, with his knee on the neck of a pleading and gasping Mr. Floyd for almost 9 minutes. The police officers had responded to a call from a shop owner claiming Mr. Floyd had tried to pass off a counterfeit $20 bill. His death sparked protests across the United States about racial injustice. Justice and police brutality. Earlier, I spoke to Katrina Pross. She's a reporting fellow at the Pioneer Press in Minneapolis. And I asked her, given the protests and the worldwide publicity this case has attracted, how difficult will it be to select a jury?
According to a lot of legal experts, it's really, really hard. And this process is going to take a lot longer than it normally would. It's going to take about 3 weeks, but it could take longer than that. It really just depends. And they're going to be questioning jurors pretty carefully, individually, one by one, which is something that they don't always do. But yeah, it's going to be really hard to find jurors that haven't heard about this or formulated an opinion about it. I did talk to one legal expert, though, who said that Hennepin County, which is the county in Minnesota where Minneapolis is quite a large county that does encompass some rural areas as well. So it's possible that people in more rural areas are not quite as up to speed on the trial and may not have formulated as much of an opinion on it. But nevertheless, it's going to be extremely difficult. So I think we just kind of have to wait and see how long it takes.
You were at the courthouse when the trial convened yesterday. What was that like? Were there protests outside?
Yeah, there were a lot of protests outside. They were all peaceful, though, and there was a lot of artwork and signs, and people were chanting. And so, yeah, all throughout, mostly in the morning, there were a lot of protests. And as far as media, only two reporters are allowed in the courtroom each day. So the rest of us, including myself, were across the street in a media workroom, which was, I think, a new thing for a lot of us. It's due to the COVID-19 pandemic and social distancing. Only so many people can be allowed inside.
Of course, and is the family of George Floyd able to be present?
So there is one seat available for Mr. Floyd's family each day, and there's one seat for Mr. Chauvin's family. And today, the seat for Mr. Floyd's family was filled by his sister, Bridget Floyd. And the seat for Mr. Chauvin's family, I believe no one from his family attended. But Bridget Floyd spoke afterward, after court adjourned for the day, to the media. And she said that she encourages people to not become violent and to, you know, remember her brother and for a protest to remain peaceful. I wasn't there myself, but one of my colleagues was and listened in on her speech, and that's what he said.
And just finally, Derek Chauvin, we'll know perhaps today or later in the week as to whether that third charge will be mm-hmm. brought against him. But do we know how he's going to meet the charge? Does he say that he was following procedure?
Yeah, as far as the defense, they are likely to argue that, yes, that this was something that he was trained in and that it was a reasonable use of force. That's really going to be a really big question in this case is, was he acting reasonably? The defense is going to argue that he did, and the prosecution is obviously going to say that it wasn't reasonable. And then another huge part of this case is going to be cause of death. The defense is going to argue that because Mr. Floyd had methamphetamine and fentanyl in his system, according to an autopsy when he died, that's what caused his death, not Mr. Chauvin putting his knee on the back of Mr. Floyd's neck. So that's going to be a huge part of this case as well.
And that was Katrina Prost speaking to me earlier from Minneapolis.
The fallout from last week's record central bank fine against Davy continued last night, with the stockbroker confirming that it's to close its bond desk. It followed a decision by the National Treasury Management Agency, which said it was withdrawing Davy's authorisation to act as a primary dealer in Irish government bonds. There's been a sharp move away from buy-to-let mortgages to fund investments, according to the latest Housing Market Monitor from the Banking and Payments Federation Ireland. Property investors accounted for less than 1% of all mortgage drawdowns in 2020, down from 20% of mortgage drawdowns in 2006. Staying with property, nearly half of prospective homebuyers think prices will rise by up to 10% in the coming year, according to a survey from property website myhome.ie. Housing stock is the most important issue for prospective buyers, with 50% saying more stock on the market would encourage them to buy now. On the currencies, €1 buys 85.7 pence sterling and $1 18.6 cents.
And at 7:36, it's good morning to Darren Frehill.
Good morning to you as well, Audrey. Well, some good news from the Leinster camp. The province have confirmed that Cailín Doris is in line to make his return to action next month. The back row has been out with symptoms related to concussion, but the good news is he's back training with the squad. One of his coaches, Stuart Lancaster, has described his comeback as progressive training. So he's in and out of sessions just to build up his confidence. I think we were all a little bit worried about Cailín Doris a couple of weeks ago, when the Irish coach Andy Farrell said he didn't expect to see him back anytime soon. But this is a really positive development, and we'll hear from Stuart Lancaster later in the programme. Now, the draw for the last 16 and quarterfinals of the Champions and Challenge Cup will be made later on today. Leinster and Munster will compete in the knockout rounds of the Champions Cup, and Ulster and Connacht will learn their fate in the Challenge Cup. Chelsea climbed into the top four of the Premier League last night thanks to a 2-0 win against Everton. Kai Havertz and Jorginho with the goals there. Huge win for them because they're now fourth in the standings, only 3 points behind third place Leicester and only four off second place Manchester United. 10 games to go in the run-in. Chelsea are on quite the run as well under the new manager Thomas Tuchel, who has yet to taste defeat in his 11 matches since taking charge. He says his focus is on the standings. It's not on the standings, but just on winning games.
I did not expect nothing, so not to be disappointed and not to be surprised, because if you expect and if you do too much mathematics before games, you lose your focus and you limit yourself. I think that this club, we have everything to win every game.
West Ham are another team going really well at the moment. They continue to do so well. Fifth in the standings, just 2 points further back from Chelsea. Another big win for them last night. They beat Leeds by 2 goals. A couple of spots in the last 8 of the Champions League are up for grabs tonight. The meeting of Juventus and Porto is the live game on RTE2. And Juventus trail 2-1 from the first leg. So Cristiano Ronaldo and co have it all to do there. Borussia Dortmund have a 3-2 lead heading into their second leg of their game against Sevilla, both matches underway at 8 o'clock. Now, no medals for Team Ireland at the European Indoor Championships, but a number of our athletes came home with enhanced reputations. Among them, Phil Healy, who spoke to the Game On team last night. Phil is already setting her sights on the summer ahead.
No, I didn't come home with a medal, but to me, fourth is a medal. Like I might as well have a medal with fourth, because to produce a PB, to be that close to the medals on my third race in the 36 hours, to make a major senior final, like, I gave it everything and I'm absolutely thrilled with my performance.
I heard lots of people say really nice things about you, Phil, but something that really stuck out in my mind was the phrase that you've arrived. Do you feel like you have now, that you're, you know, you're up there, you're with the elite, you're with the world class, the international class?
100%, and like even the top three girls, like they have major international medals on the world stage and the European stage. So to be so close with them, and even the girl that was fifth behind me, like she was ranked number two in Europe all year. She's absolutely stormed the whole indoor season. So like, it's been unbelievable. And like, there's been many major championships where I have messed up and things haven't gone to plan. So to make a major senior final, to produce the quickest time that I've ever ran, I couldn't be more happy and 100% arrived on that scene and ready to take it on further into the summer.
That's Phil Healy with Marie Crowe from last night. Sam Bennett will start today's third stage at the Paris-Nice race, a time trial in third place overall, the Irish rider fifth on yesterday's stage, the lead being held by Michael Matthews. Finally, some sad news to report, I'm afraid. Former Tyrone football trainer Fergal McCann has died at the age of 47 following a long illness. Fergal was part of the management team which led the Tyrone footballers to All-Ireland success in 2005 and 2008. He was married and had two children, Ayeshe, Garau, or Anna.
The war in Syria is 10 years old this month, and while the bombing and shelling may have stopped, the refugee crisis has not. Up to half of the population has been displaced. Now today, aid agencies working on the front line will tell an Oireachtas committee that suffering in Syria is now at its worst level in a decade. Dr. Ruba Meissen is founder of the Sawa Charity for Syrian Refugees in Lebanon, and she'll be among the NGOs to address the committee. She's speaking to us now from her home in Turkey. Dr. Meissen, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning to you. Good morning, Ireland.
And you will be talking to our parliamentary committee later on today. But is there that danger that when the bombs and the bullets fall silent and the world is gripped by a pandemic, that the huge difficulties that Syria is facing, that they fall down the agenda and they become forgotten?
I mean, unfortunately, we live today in a world where there's more and more problems in every country. There are humanitarian crises and natural disasters happening every day. And it's true that it's been 10 years today since the Syrian people went out to the streets to demonstrate for their freedom and dignity. It's been 10 years on the ongoing geopolitical war that's happening on our soil. However, the problems haven't stopped. We're still living in very precarious situation, facing so many dangers day in and day out. And unfortunately, today Syria seems not to be on the world priority list anymore.
So what are the problems that Syrians are facing, and facing both within the country and in refugee camps in Lebanon, where you are, and elsewhere?
Out of 20 million Syrians today, there are 12 million that are amongst displaced or refugees, half of them inside the country and half of them in neighboring countries, some of them also abroad in Europe. Those who are living in the country are living in a country where the war is ongoing. The dictator that is ruling over Syria is still very much in power. The armed factions still in Syria. There is a hyperinflation in the country, lack of services, lack of water, lack of sanitation. When it comes to neighboring countries, Syria's neighboring countries are also developing countries with very bad infrastructure in the country itself, very bad services. In Lebanon, for instance, as you may know, there is also hyperinflation, very scarce resources, and most of the refugees living in tents. In winter, for example, they have to move once or twice or three times every year because their tents get wet from the water, their children are out of school, and they face very, very hard conditions, whether inside Syria or in neighboring countries.
And is there a move now by countries like Lebanon or Turkey to repatriate refugees because Syria is seen as a more peaceful place?
Unfortunately, like everywhere else in the world, refugees are becoming yet another card in the hands of politicians that they use, a divisive card that they use to gain voters on their end or to blame or scapegoat their own problems on. So in Lebanon now, with a failed economic system, very difficult conditions, and in Turkey it's the same, the refugees are always being blamed for all these problems. And there are real talks about returning these refugees home. But returning these refugees home means that they risk being kidnapped, they risk being forcibly disappeared, they risk being imprisoned for their political views. They also risk men risk being taken forcefully into military service to fight their own brothers and sisters in Syria. And a lot of people don't want that. In addition, a lot of the parents, you know, Syrians are just humans, and a lot of the parents don't want to go back to Syria because simply there are no school infrastructures for their children. There are no hospitals today. Okay. Most of Syrian cities are, you know, on the ground, so they want at least the basic services to be there for them to return.
And is that your message to Irish parliamentarians today?
I mean, my message, first of all, to all the Irish population is thank you so much for your generosity. I think Ireland has always been a generous contributor and stands in, you know, with all the just causes. You know, we have been working in the past years with the support of TOCRA, an Irish, very well-known, you know, organizations where Irish people have been generously donating for us. But also my message for the Parliament is Ireland today is on the has a seat in the UN Security Council, and, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. So we really count on Irish politicians to work and put all their effort into stopping the war in Syria so that people can indeed go back to their country where they want to be. But also that the humanitarian crisis isn't over, as I said. So we still count on generous governments to support refugees in neighboring countries, but also to increase the number of refugees resettled into other countries.
Dr. Ruba Meissen, thank you for your time this morning on Morning Ireland. It's 12 minutes to 8.
The Department of Children has announced that St. John Ambulance Ireland will carry out an independent review into the management of child sexual abuse allegations in the organisation. It will be led by the internationally recognised expert in child protection, Dr. Geoffrey Shannon. Our social affairs and religion correspondent, Alva Keneally, joins us now. Alva, how did the review come about?
Well, the Minister for Children, Roderick O'Gorman, he met with St. John Ambulance before Christmas last year to discuss the subject of historical sexual abuse allegations. Now, St. John's Ambulance, it is a charitable organisation and it teaches the practice of medical first aid. So you're talking about a very big organisation with thousands of volunteers. And in its terms of reference into this review published last night by the organisation, it states that it's aware of a number of complaints of sexual abuse of members under the age of 18 years going back 20 years ago regarding a former volunteer. So effectively, this was the initial basis on which the review has been established. And I understand a number of victims have already come forward. And there has been liaison with the Gardaí to ensure that there's no overlap with ongoing cases in relation to St. John Ambulance.
Do we know at this point how comprehensive the review will be?
Well, considering it's been carried out by Dr. Geoffrey Shannon, it's expected to be very comprehensive. He was the government's special rapporteur on child protection from 2006 up until 2019. And he was a lead author into the review of the deaths of almost 200 children in state care between 2000 and 2010. And victims that come forward for this review, they'll be telling their stories to him. Now, in terms of the terms of reference set out, they show that the review will look into the manner in which the complaints in relation to sexual abuse that were made to the organisation were dealt with when the issue first emerged 20 years ago and then again 8 years ago. And it'll examine how those complaints were dealt with in relation to government guidance on child protection and St. John Ambulance policies at that time. Now, it'll also look at any other complaints regarding grooming or abuse. And then it'll assess current arrangements in place for the protection of children and vulnerable adults.
And has St. John Ambulance agreed how the review will be funded and resourced?
We don't have an insight into details yet on how much the review will be funded. But if you take into account that the minister met with St. John Ambulance in December and the review was then announced last night, in that context, it has happened relatively quickly. But victims have yet to be directed on how they can contact Dr. Shannon and his team. Now, I understand it'll be a small team. It'll be a victim-led approach. So people who do come forward, their stories will be taken in confidence. But the review is also going to have to trawl through all of St. John non-ambulance files going back decades. So this is an organisation which was established almost 100 years ago in this country. So there's quite a bit of work involved, and this could lead to a substantial amount of information being unearthed. But funding will have to be worked out, because I understand that the team is scheduled to begin its work in a matter of weeks.
Thank you very much, Alva. Alva Keneally, our social affairs and religion correspondent.
The fallout from last week's record central bank fine against Davy continued last night, with the stockbroker confirming that it's to close its bond desk. It followed a decision by the National Treasury Management Agency, which said it was withdrawing Davy's authorisation to act as a primary dealer in Irish government bonds. We're joined this morning by Associate Professor Emeritus of Economics at DCU, Tony Foley. Tony, a significant move by Davy to close its bond desk. Is it enough to contain the crisis there?
No, it depends what you mean by the crisis, because we have the Oireachtas Finance Committee today meeting the central bank, and they'll have questions on it. We know very little about the detail of this. We know what happened in 2014, but we don't really know of the current board and senior people who knew what, when they knew it, what they did about it in the 7 years since 2014. So there's a lot to come, yes, and I particularly the role of individuals in it as opposed to the company, because obviously the company has been fined the 4.1 million, but the individuals concerned are still, I presume, benefiting from whatever profits they made from the deal, which would have been a non-ethical approach to operating their business. So there's a lot of things yet to be finalised. There's also the particular argument that Davy make that this couldn't happen again. Well, we don't know that. We don't know, have they changed their systems fundamentally? Is it a situation where they have an entirely new regulatory system where this couldn't possibly happen? But it did happen. So the problem is really that this happened in 2014. The central bank's fine is 2021. 7 years to sort this out. And in effect, it wasn't the central bank's investigation that found out about this. It was a legal case brought by the offended client, as it were, which then brought it into public notice. So it's a very long period to wait for, as it were, appropriate action by the central bank. So I presume the Finance Committee today will want to know, why is it taking so long? What was the timeline? Is it guaranteed it can't be repeatable? And basically, who knew what and when they knew it and what did they do about it?
Plenty of questions at the Oireachtas Committee today. A bond auction is due to take place this Thursday. Now, the NTMA announced yesterday that it's to remove Davy's authority to act as a primary dealer of Irish government bonds. Could the sale be impacted by what happened at Davy?
It shouldn't be. It'd be interesting to see, can it, but it shouldn't be. There's normally around, I suppose in one sense, primary bond dealers go in and out, as aware of the list. There's currently 15. Davy brings it down to 14. They're some of the biggest international names in the financial services industry. So it obviously it removes some of the client base that Davy would have had, because one of the roles of the primary dealers is that they participate in the auctions. So Davy would have presumably had clients who wants to buy government bonds. They would have participated in the auction on their behalf. But in recent times, most of the auctions have been oversubscribed, so the NTMA could have sold more bonds than they did. So I would imagine it shouldn't make much difference. And I would think that the NTMA acted so quickly to, as it were, almost make sure that the other operators would basically say are operating on appropriate criteria. There's nothing untoward here. So I would expect the deal, the sale will go ahead broadly as they would have expected, without any dramatic effect. In one sense, and I say it's only, because it's a lot of money, it's only up to $1.5 billion they're looking for, and it's in two tranches, a 10-year bond and a 29-year bond. And the market at the moment is very receptive to those kind of bonds. So I don't think there should be any particular problem in terms of selling as they would have envisaged.
And Tony, very, very briefly, if you don't mind, how important is reputation in financial services?
Well, I suppose, to be honest, if you look at what's happened in the past, not very important, is it? Because banks, in terms of our own international crisis, major collapses, Baring Bank and so on, crisis and various other international names, and they're still functioning, as it were. So it should be much more important, and probably is reasonable to say that the public perception of a requirement for ethics is stronger now than it would have been in the past. Okay. This is not the first financial, I suppose, unethical situation we've had in the Irish economy, and basically financial institutions have carried on. So if you look at the tracker mortgage situation, the banks are still functioning, but they behaved badly in terms of that with clients. So it should be much more than it is, and unfortunately maybe it's not as strong as it should be.
Tony Foley, Associate Professor Emeritus of Economics at DCU, thank you for your time this morning. More on the Davy story after 8, and I'll have more business news at 8.30.
While low pressure will dominate the weather this week, bringing wet and windy weather at times, and will remain unsettled through to the weekend. Today it's a cloudy start and dry in many areas, with outbreaks of rain and drizzle in western parts. This rain will move eastwards today, turning persistent and heavier in the afternoon as it spreads nationwide. And it will become windy today. Strong southerly winds will reach western areas later this morning and spreading to all other areas later in the afternoon, reaching near gale force near coasts. Highs today of 8 to 11 degrees. Continuing wet and windy early tonight, although it will dry up during the night and winds will die down, staying mostly cloudy though, with lows of 2 to 5 degrees, coldest over the north. The rain will return quickly in the morning tomorrow, however, and conditions will turn wet and windy again. The rain will occur in most areas and it will be pretty heavy in places, followed by heavier squally showers in the afternoon. Southwest winds will become strong and gusty again tomorrow, particularly strong going into the evening and night, and winds will be strongest along the west and south, reaching gale force across southwestern fringes where gusts will be strongest. A yellow level wind warning is in place for western and southern coastal counties, coming into effect tomorrow midday through to Wednesday night. It will remain rather windy or breezy through Thursday and Friday, and feeling colder as well, with frequent blustery showers mixed with some sunny spells. Showers will be heavy, somewhat hail, possibly thunder, with gusty winds. And there'll be another batch of rain with some strong winds in areas on Friday night, and then it seems like the weekend will also bring further breezy conditions with rain or showers. Cold on Saturday, but becoming a bit mild again on Sunday. But to recap for today, cloudy to begin, with some rain or drizzle in the west, becoming wet and windy everywhere in the afternoon, with highs of 8 to 11 degrees. And that's all from me. Have a lovely morning.
The Cabinet will this morning consider a proposal from the Housing Minister, Dara O'Brien, to extend protections for tenants whose incomes have been affected by the pandemic. The Residential Tenancies and Valuation Bill had been due to lapse on the 12th of April, but is to be renewed for 3 months. Our political correspondent, Micheál Lehan.
This legislation protects tenants from eviction until July if they have been negatively impacted by COVID-19 and are facing rent arrears. It also prevents any rent increases for those who find themselves in this predicament, provided they make a self-declaration that their incomes have fallen as a result of the pandemic. However, the blanket ban on all evictions will expire within 10 days of the 5-kilometre limit ending. That limit is set to remain in place until April 5th, but it will be reviewed in the lead-up to that date. Cabinet will also today discuss the planned extension of parents' leave from 2 to 5 weeks, as announced in the last budget. This measure will be contained in the Family Leave Bill, and it is within this piece of legislation that government will include amendments to quickly progress through the Oireachtas, the new personal injuries guidelines. Guidelines government hope will reduce litigation, awards and ultimately insurance costs.
The number of patients with COVID-19 in hospitals has fallen below 400 for the first time this year. New figures from the HSE put the number at 392, our health correspondent Fergal Bowers.
Ireland is in the late stages of the third wave of COVID-19 and all key indicators are improving. Daily hospital admissions have been reducing in recent weeks, and latest figures from the HSE show that there were 392 patients with the disease in hospital last night. It marks a reduction of 26 patients on what was reported this time yesterday. The number of patients in intensive care is 101, a small reduction on the situation earlier yesterday. NPHET has said that there is sustained and perhaps even accelerated progress in suppressing transmission of COVID-19 in Ireland.
More than 79,000 applications for third-level courses were received by the Central Applications Office by its February 1st closing date. The figure is an increase of over 6,200 on last year. Theresa Mannion reports.
One of the most popular course choices for 2021 is business and administration, with over 8,700 first preference applications, a 6% increase on last year. And there was a significant rise in those wanting to study nursing and midwifery. Almost 6,000 students applied, compared to around 5,000 the previous year, a 20% increase. Meanwhile, numbers wishing to train as primary school teachers have remained largely unchanged, with over 2,700 applications. 1,900 students applied for secondary teaching, an 8% drop. There's an increase in numbers choosing engineering, up 7% to over 4,000. And applications to study law are down 5%, with almost 2,800 applications.
The Oireachtas Committee on Finance, Public Expenditure and Reform will hear from the Central Bank today that the regulatory framework requires further strengthening when it comes to holding individuals to account for breaches. It follows a fine of €4.1 million the bank levied against stockbrokers Davy last week. Our business editor, Will Goodbody.
In its probe, the central bank found Davy had breached several regulations around a 2014 deal where a client sold a bond to a buyer but wasn't told the purchaser was a consortium of 16 Davy staff. Three senior figures at Davy resigned on foot of the findings last weekend, while the National Treasury Management Agency yesterday withdrew the firm's authority to act as a primary dealer in Irish government bonds. Today, the issue is expected to be centre stage when the Oireachtas Finance Committee hears from representatives of the central bank. In her opening statement, its Director General of Financial Conduct, Derville Rowland, will say robust enforcement action is a critical component of the central bank's work to protect consumers. But her statement also says that notwithstanding the strong suite of existing enforcement powers the bank has, it does believe that the regulatory framework requires further strengthening with regard to individual accountability.
The Vice President of the European Commission, Maros Šefčovič, is to brief EU ambassadors today on legal action being prepared against the UK. It follows last week's decision by London to unilaterally change the way the Northern Ireland Protocol is being implemented. RT News understands there will be two parallel legal moves against the UK, which could be finalised this week. From Brussels, our Europe editor Tony Connolly.
When the Northern Ireland Secretary Brandon Lewis announced last week that the UK would extend the grace periods, which have delayed some of the full impacts of the protocol, the EU accused the UK of a breach of the withdrawal agreement and a potential breach of international law. Today, Maros Šefčovič, the EU's co-chair of the joint committee which oversees the implementation of the withdrawal agreement, will update member states on the legal options. It's understood the EU will launch an infringement procedure against the UK, which could end up in the European Court of Justice. A second legal track would be through the withdrawal agreement. However, London will insist its move does not breach the withdrawal agreement and is practical and proportionate. Tony Connolly, RTE News, Brussels.
Further fallout from the Davy controversy, the vaccine rollout programme and the royal response to that interview are some of the stories you'll find on your front pages this morning. The Irish Times leads with the line that following yesterday's move by the NTMA to withdraw Davy's ability to act as a primary dealer of Irish government bonds, the stockbroking firm closed its bond desk, resulting in four redundancies as it raced to contain the crisis triggered by the record central bank fine it received last week. The Irish Examiner reports on its front page, meanwhile, that all of the 16 employees who were involved in the rogue bond trade in 2014 have since left the company. Writing inside today's Times, meanwhile, Fintan O'Toole also devotes his column to those 16 employees. Right at the time when our wounds were raw and still bleeding, these people stuck in the knife of greed and arrogance and unabashed entitlement. Even after everything that happened, they asserted their right to carry on regardless. We know all the costs of impunity, O'Toole writes. If these individuals get away with it, we deserve the consequences. The Irish Daily Star quotes comments made by the Deputy Chief Medical Officer Ronan Glynn yesterday, in which he said that he believes that the vaccination programme could lead to an easing of the lockdown within weeks. back in the front of the Times. However, it's reported that Ireland is set to receive less than half the deliveries of vaccines it originally expected in the first 3 months of the year. The Irish Independent builds its lead story today around the increase in the number of college applications, which you'll also have heard covered in the bulletin. The Oprah Winfrey interview with Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, which was broadcast on RTE television last night, generates the lead story in the Irish Daily Mail, Irish Daily Mirror and Irish Sun. Worst royal crisis in 85 years is the headline in the Mirror, while the Mail reports that the royal family was paralysed with horror and dismay last night as Prince Harry stood accused of blowing up his family with his bombshell interview. For its lead story, The Examiner reports that 111 cases of investment frauds amounting to more than €4 million in losses were reported last year. Gardaí believe, however, that the actual number could be tens of millions of euro since many people are too embarrassed to report the crime. Cormac O'Keefe reports that many of the recent crimes involve virtual frauds such as Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. The lack of a police presence at street celebrations in Belfast on Sunday night, when Rangers fans celebrated their team's victory in the Scottish League, is covered as the lead story in the Irish News. For its lead story, the Belfast Telegraph reports on criticisms of Stormont's plan to exit the current lockdown by Professor Gabriel Scally. Elsewhere this morning, Dublin's Poolbeg chimney stacks may have to be encased in fiberglass or concrete to ensure their long-term survival, according to Dublin City Council. That's in the front of the Times. And the Independent reports today on an urban regeneration fund of €25 million for towns in the Midlands, €10 million of which is to go to Longford. Tullamore, Portlaoise and Athlone are to receive the rest of the funding. And finally, The Examiner has a story today about a picture taken by UCC employee Maria Curran of a ship off the coast of Cork, which appears to be hovering in mid-air. A similar picture, known as the Flying Ship, taken by a British photographer, which went viral recently, prompted Maria to revisit her picture, which she took back in October, and she has since discovered is caused by a mirage that happens most commonly in the Arctic Circle when cold air lies close to the sea with warm air above it. And you can see Maria's picture on page 2 of today's Examiner.
Well, the fallout for Davy following the central bank €4.13 million fine over the 2014 bond deal continues. Three senior members at Davy resigned, as you know, at the weekend, while the National Treasury Management Agency yesterday withdrew the firm's authority to act as a primary dealer in Irish government bonds. The stockbroker has now closed its bond desk. Today the issue will be centre stage when the central bank appears before the Oireachtas Committee on Finance. Our reporter Fiacra Kiana has been speaking to some members of that committee ahead of today's hearing.
How many more people are involved? How much money was made in the deal? And indeed, has it been returned to employers? From the central bank, I want to know what actions can they take? What actions will they take? Because I think this is an issue that's an example for the entire industry, and we need to ensure we have full transparency and full clarity.
The central bank will today answer questions from TDs and senators at the Oireachtas Joint Committee on Finance, Public Expenditure and Reform. Among the questioners will be Fine Gael TD for Dublin Rathdown, Neil Richmond. Deputy Richmond says the decision by the National Treasury Management Agency to withdraw Davy's authority to act as a primary dealer for Irish government bonds means more answers are now needed on what happened at the company.
It's a fairly major move by the NTMA. It has a massive knock-on effect for the Irish economy and indeed our entire system when it comes to bonds and treasury management. And what's very important to know is what are the medium and long-term effects of this ruling.
Mick Barry is Solidarity People Before Profit TD for Cork North Central and will also attend today's meeting. He says the legacy of the Celtic Tiger crash means while specific details should be examined, the committee will also need to take a wider view of events.
We've seen what happened at Anglo more than a decade ago. We've seen what's happened at Davy here. I think you'd be very naive to think this culture of entitlement, this feeling that we are untouchable, is confined to a couple of corners of the world of high finance.
A third committee member is Fianna Fáil TD for Dublin Bay South, Jim O'Callaghan. Deputy O'Callaghan says in addition to Deputy Barry and Deputy Richmond's concerns, the central bank also needs to answer questions about its own actions.
I'll be asking them why it hasn't invoked the powers the Oireachtas gave it for the protection of investors to apply to the High Court for the appointment of inspectors to investigate whether there were similar types of transactions. I'll be asking why it never instituted proceedings against individuals or the corporate entity for what were serious breaches of regulations. I'll be asking what sanction the central bank imposed on the person in Davy who misled Davy compliance. In fact, I'd like to know what sanction the Davy board imposed on that person when it first became aware of it. And finally, I'll be asking how a regulated entity can deliberately provide misleading information to the central bank during an investigation, and the central bank views that merely as an aggravating factor. Davy obviously plays a very important part in Irish financial services. It needs to get its house in order, and the central bank also needs to answer questions.
A fourth committee member is Sinn Féin TD for Galway West, Mairead Farrell. Deputy Farrell says the Davy controversy shows a culture shift is needed in the financial sector, but that a shift can only happen if questions are fully answered by the individuals involved.
Cultural change simply won't happen unless there is personal accountability. And what I will be raising with the central bank is what investigation be taking place in terms of the 16 individuals. Have they, for example, sent files to the Gardaí? And I want to know, are the central bank going to do a wider investigation to find out if this is a once-off or if this is indeed a wider issue? And I'd like to know if the other 13 individuals have remained in leadership positions, if they have potentially moved to other positions in other bodies, potentially in public bodies. We need to have these kind of answers from the central bank.
A number of questions there being posed by legislators who are on the Oireachtas Finance Committee, which will be convening today, and the central bank appearing before them. Here to tell us more, our business editor, Will Goodbody. Will, let's talk first of all about this move by the NTMA yesterday to remove Davy's authority to act as a primary dealer of Irish government bonds. More answers needed, Neil Richmond was saying in that clip with Fiacra O'Kiona. What is the significance of that decision?
Well, Mary, it was a big deal in a number of ways. I mean, the NTMA is responsible for managing Ireland's national debt. And when it goes to borrow on the international market, it uses 15 primary dealers who essentially market and find buyers for those bonds. Now, Davy was one of those, the only Irish-owned one, and has been acting in this role for quite some time. And it was important for two reasons. I suppose, first, there was an element of prestige to it. It could use this as a marketing tool for itself when trying to win new clients and business by saying, look, you know, we act on behalf of the Irish government. So it was a sort of a badge of honour, I suppose. But it was also quite a lucrative arrangement because even though there was no remuneration from the state attached to being a primary dealer, it did enable Davy to get involved in much larger Irish government bond deals. These are known as syndications. And through this, it was able to make quite significant amounts of fee income each year. But what the NTMA said yesterday was essentially that it no longer wished to do business with Davy, as it feared the potential for the central bank findings in the Davy investigation could do damage to Ireland's reputation. And so that means that Davy won't be able to take part in Thursday's upcoming bond auction of up to 1.5 billion euro in bonds or subsequent auctions for that matter. Now, that shouldn't be a huge issue for the state as such in terms of next Thursday's auction because, as I say, there are 14 other primary dealers, although none of those are now Irish-owned brokers and banks any longer. But overall, the decision amounts to a huge kick in the teeth for Davy, not only financially, but also in relation to its reputation. And you'd have to wonder if that's what the NTMA thinks of Davy. What are all its other customers, including large companies here, thinking? And what might they do in response?
And for Davy, the crisis goes on. More questions being posed today. Yesterday, closing the bond desk after the NTMA decision. Will that be enough, though? Does it need to go further? Does it need to answer questions before a finance committee and more?
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly Davy has been severely criticised by the central bank since the central bank issued its findings and fine yesterday. And first of all, Davy didn't issue any public statement initially until it came under pressure to do so from politicians. It then took 4 days before we saw any resignations, with the chief executive, deputy chairman and heads of bonds stepping down. And by this stage, the unanswered questions were mounting about the other 13 members of the consortium and whether they still worked there. So after the NTMA announced yesterday that it was ditching Davy, there then came a statement from the stockbroker to say that on foot of the central bank's findings and the NTMA's decision, it had decided to close its bond desk with immediate effect. It said this would result in 4 redundancies, and the decision now means that none of the 16 members of the consortium who took part in the 2014 transaction at issue in this case were working for it any longer. So clearly an attempt by the board and the management team, led by the new interim chief executive, Bernard Byrne, to draw a line in the sand on this issue. But I think it's very clear that the issues aren't going to go away anytime soon. still many issues to be answered around individual accountability, about what happens to the shares in the business owned by those who have left, and also what else might the ongoing internal inquiry at Davy find, and how will other clients act following the NTMA's decision yesterday?
Questions too for the central bank as posed there by Jim O'Callaghan. What are we expecting from that appearance at the Oireachtas Committee today?
Yeah, well, technically they're coming in to discuss banking matters, but I think we can expect the session will be dominated by the Davy situation. We heard earlier what those members of the committee feel need to be addressed. But for the central bank's part, I think we can expect a robust defence of its actions to date around enforcement generally, and in this case in particular. And in her opening statement given to the committee, the Director of Financial Conduct, Dulva Rowland, says the reprimand and fine imposed on Davy reflected the serious regulatory breaches and aggregating factors in the investigation, including the firm's lack of candour when first reporting the matter to the central bank. She also tells the committee that robust enforcement action is a critical component of the central bank's work to protect consumers and investors and key parts of its regulatory and supervisory toolkit. But her statement also says that notwithstanding the strong suite of existing enforcement powers the bank has, it does believe that the regulatory framework requires further strengthening with regard to individual accountability, and that the bank regards the individual accountability framework, including the introduction of conduct standards for individuals and this talked about a lot in the last couple of days, the senior executive accountability regime, as necessary enhancements to its supervisory and enforcement toolkit. Just separately, Mary, the committee also wrote to Davy earlier this week to seek information and answers. And yesterday, interim CEO Bernard Byrne wrote back to the committee, and he outlined the steps that have been taken since the letter was sent, including the senior resignations at the weekend, the closure of the bond desk yesterday, the appointment of him as new interim CEO, and that the Davy board now comprises executive and non-executive directors who were not there in 2014. But he also said, and interestingly said, that an independent third party will be appointed imminently, aimed at conducting a review of matters arising from the central bank's findings in ensuring appropriate assessment of other relevant activity and to determine the adequacy of enhanced compliance controls and governance designed to prevent possible conflicts. So an independent person to be appointed there. He also echoed the board's unequivocal apology and regret, saying the company is truly sorry.
Okay, Will, you'll be reporting throughout the day. Our business correspondent, Will Goodbody, at 24 minutes past eight.
This week we've been told by the HSE that 10,000 people with neurological conditions will receive the COVID-19 vaccine. They are part of a group of around 160,000 with very serious health conditions and illnesses who have been moved up the vaccination schedule. They include those receiving treatment for cancer, those who have chronic respiratory and kidney diseases, uncontrolled diabetes. But as we heard on the programme yesterday, there is still much confusion as to how this round of jabs will be organised. Will it be through the patient's GPs or their hospital doctors? What is the timeline for the vaccine? Well, to help us answer some of these questions, we hope this morning we are joined by Professor Martin Cormacan, who is the HSE's clinical lead on infection control. Professor Cormacan, thank you for joining us on Morning Ireland. The first question, I suppose, is the fact that there is no register containing the names of all of these people who will be affected. So how will you ensure that no one is missed?
Yeah, thank you. So the first thing is it's good to have this challenge because it's really important to get vaccine to this group. So and the HSE worked very with NIAC to develop this process. So it is a big challenge, but it's a challenge that we're happy to have. So there are a couple of ways that we need to work through this. And as you said, there isn't a central register. So the process that we're looking at is trying to find as many people as we can on the list as quickly as we can and to get started with vaccinating them. And then we will need to put in place further processes to identify the people that we might not have gotten the first round. So the approach that we're taking is the place that we can identify a lot of these people fairly quickly in the very high-risk group will be through the hospital system. We know that that won't work perfectly, but we know that it will help us to find a lot of those people pretty quickly and to get started with vaccinating them as quickly as possible. And then we will have to work with other processes through the community processes to identify other people. So what we're going to do first is going to be get to many people quickly, but it's certainly not going to be perfect, and we will have to work to find the other people because, as you say, there is no central register.
Yeah, and can you give us an idea of who will be in that very top group? Who are your absolute priority? Who can expect a call first?
So the NIAC document has set out, and this is complicated, and I know that it's difficult for patients, that there are 13 different groups, in the very high-risk group. And whether you're in the very high-risk group or the high-risk group depends not only on the condition that you have, but the severity of the condition that you have. So what we will be doing is trying to identify the people in that very high-risk group, which are the people with the conditions that have been named, the diagnosis that has been named, and who have a certain severity of disease that puts them at very high risk. So within the groups, there will be patients who have cancer, chronic kidney disease, chronic neurological disease, chronic respiratory disease, immunocompromise, a number of other conditions that we'll be working through. We'll be trying to find all of those people with the different diagnoses equally quickly, but what we are trying to do is to find the people who are at most risk the fastest, the very high-risk group, which we call it, which the NIAC have called Group 4.
Group 4. And when can they realistically expect to get a call?
Some people will be vaccinated this week, but and more next week. I'm not going to give you a definite date because we have to. If we give you dates, we have to be sure that we can deliver on them. We will be getting to some people this week. It's likely to be next week before we start to get to most people. But I can give you an assurance and an assurance to the patients that we are as anxious to get to you as you are to anxious to get the vaccine, because it's in everybody's interest that we get this vaccine to you as quickly as possible. But it is a big challenge. We are working flat out on it, and we will get to you as quickly as we can. But I think for most people, it's probably going to be next week before we get to most people.
Most people. And who will make that call? Who will they hear from? Will it be their hospital or will it be their GP, who probably have the closest relationship with them?
Yeah, the relationships here, there are many patients with these complex diagnoses have very close relationships both with their hospital and their general practitioner because they receive care regularly from both. So from our point of view at this point, it's not about who they have the closest relationship with, but where we can find them and contact them. And at the moment, we expect that most of these people that we will start to contact, I should say, it's not that we will reach everybody next week. We hope to start to reach significant numbers next week, and we expect them to be contacted through the hospital at this point. But there will be people, as we go through the process, that will be contacted by other routes, because we know that the hospital process won't allow us to pick up everyone. As I say, there's this compromise between being fast and being perfect, and what we want to do is reach the people we can reach as quickly as possible and reach all the other people, you know, as well. But we're not going to wait until we have a perfect list to start vaccinating the people we can find next week.
Do you have an end target date for the first doses for this group?
Well, we would hope to have most people in this group done in the month of March, but it does depend, as you know, on vaccine supply, and it depends on other issues. And in the nature of a group that's as complicated as this, it may be that there are people that it takes us some time to find. So I don't think you can give a definite end date on this, but the goal would be to get as many of them as possible that we can identify done by the end of the month. But I can't give you, you know, a date at which I can promise you that everybody in this group will be done, because it's a very complex group. But the goal is to get to most of the people in this group by end of March or early April.
Okay. If someone is highly immunosuppressed, will the vaccine have any impact?
That's a very good question, and the vaccine we expect will have some impact on many people who are highly immunosuppressed, but the benefit for people who are very immunosuppressed may be less. However, all of these vaccines help you to, they greatly reduce your chance of having severe disease or death as a result of COVID. If we give it to somebody whose immune system isn't working perfectly, they may not get the full benefit that somebody else will get from it, but they may get enough benefit to reduce the risk of severe disease. So it will not work as well in many people with very severe immune compromise, but even if it works a bit, if it partly works in people whose immune system isn't working very well, that partly working may still be enough to help to keep them from very severe disease.
I want to ask you about the vaccine bonus, as it's been called, what it is that we will be able to do when a number of people have been fully vaccinated. Will it, for example, are you expecting that perhaps nursing homes at some point coming soon will be able to invite loved ones in to visit their families again?
Well, Yes, I mean, there is already visiting should be happening in nursing homes already. The existing policy is that that visiting should be happening on a limited basis for most people and for people who have critical or compassionate grounds. And visiting should be happening now in nursing homes. So although visiting is suspended in general, there is an allowance for critical and compassionate visiting, and that includes visiting, you know, everybody, even if there's no other critical grounds, should be expecting that their nursing home should be facilitating a certain amount of visiting. We are looking at that visiting guidance again now, and we would hope to see a progressive improvement in opportunities for visiting as we go forward. But it's really important to be clear that although visiting is generally suspended in the vast majority of nursing homes, unless there's something very specific going on there, some visiting is permitted within the existing guidance, and some visiting is permitted for everybody in nursing homes. I shouldn't say permitted, but I should say facilitated by the existing guidance for everybody in nursing homes now, unless it's a nursing home that has something very specific, like a major outbreak going on. And even in those circumstances, the existing guidance says that if it's a critical circumstance, like somebody who's approaching end of life, some accommodation should be made for that person.
Okay, and just for older people who've been fully vaccinated, I know friends, parents who that has happened to in recent weeks, and they're excitedly planning little trips away in Ireland with their friends who also have been vaccinated. Is that allowed?
At the moment, and I know this is very frustrating for people, we're saying, can you hold on? I mean, we are seeing now the international guidance starting to move, and we're starting to see a change and increased that the advice to people who have been vaccinated is that they can do more things than they were able to do before the vaccine. But we feel we're not quite there yet. We are working through this as a group, very actively looking at how we might change the guidance as more people are vaccinated. But for now, we're asking people, and I know it's hard, but we're asking people to hold on for the moment. It is still a complex situation. Vaccines are good and are making a huge difference already, but they're not perfect. And we're still seeing a fair amount of community transmission. So for now, we're asking people to please to hold on, be patient. We know the urgency, and the urgency is there for all of our families to start to see each other again. And we are working on looking at how we can advise on a bit more freedom for people who've been vaccinated as the weeks go on.
Okay, thank you very much for talking to us this morning, Professor Martin Cormacan, who is the HSE's clinical lead on infection control. It's 8:34.
The fallout from last week's central bank fine against Davy continued last night, with the stockbroker confirming that it's to close its bond desk. It followed a decision by the NTMA, which said it was withdrawing Davy's authorisation to act as a primary dealer in Irish government bonds. There's been a sharp move away from buy-to-let mortgages to fund investments, according to the Housing Market Monitor from the Banking and Payments Federation. Property investors accounted for less than 1% of all mortgage drawdowns in 2020, down from 20% of mortgage drawdowns in 2006. On the currencies, €1 buys 85.7 pence sterling and $1 18.8.
And at 8:40, it's good morning again to Darren.
Hello again, Audrey. Some good news for Leinster and Irish rugby fans. Leinster have confirmed that Caelan Doris is in line to make his return to action next month. Now, the back row has been sidelined with a concussion-related issue, and I think we were all a little bit worried when the Irish coach, Andy Farrell, said he didn't expect him to see him back anytime soon very recently. But this is a really positive development. He's been eased back into collective sessions, and senior coach at Leinster, Stuart Lancaster, has been telling us more.
Yeah, so he's doing like a progressive return to contact. So he's been doing like non-contact training, in and out of sessions, just to build up confidence, I guess. So yeah, he's on the road to recovery, and I think, you know, we're hopeful that he'll get back playing again soon, within the next month. Yeah, you know, it's like a progressive return to play on the back of a concussion. So depends on the reaction, but you know, he's certainly making moves in the right direction, and physically he's in great shape. Yeah, we're optimistic.
Yeah, the Guinness Pro 14 final might come a little too soon for Caelan Doris, but maybe we'll see him in Europe towards the end of the season. That draw for the last 16 and the quarterfinals of the Champions and the Challenge Cup will be made today. Leinster and Munster will compete in the Champions Cup knockout rounds, and Ulster and Connacht will earn their Challenge Cup fate. Now, Chelsea climbed into the top four of the Premier League last night after a 2-0 win against Everton. Chelsea are now fourth in the standings, only 3 points behind Leicester City, who are third. West Ham are fifth, just 2 points adrift of Chelsea after a 2-0 win against Leeds. Seamus Coleman missed that game again for Everton last night. He's actually missed the last three matches, but in an interview afterwards, his manager Carlo Ancelotti confirmed he will be back at the weekend, and that's big and good and welcome news ahead of Ireland's World Cup qualifiers, which are coming up in a matter of weeks. No word on Darren Randolph, who played for West Ham 2 weeks ago, but then picked up an injury. He was actually deputising for Lucas Fabianski. He picked up a hip injury and he wasn't on the bench again last night. So that's a little bit of a concern. Now, a couple of spots in the quarterfinals of the Champions League are up for grabs tonight. The meeting of Juventus and Porto is the live game on RT2. Juve trail 2-1 from the first leg. Borussia Dortmund have a 3-2 lead heading into the second leg of their match against Sevilla. Both matches underway at 8 o'clock. And George Hamilton, our commentator who's on duty for us tonight in that match between Juventus and Porto, joins me on the line. Are Juve under a bit of pressure tonight, George?
They certainly are, yes. You think of the way that the things have gone for them. They're going for the 10th league title in a row, but despite the fact that they won the 9th league title in a row last year, Sarri, the former Chelsea manager, he was sacked after only one season despite retaining the Scudetto because they went out at this stage last year in a shock defeat by Lyon. And it's the same thing now. Andrea Pirlo, who hadn't managed at this level, who was just appointed under-23 manager for Juventus, got the step up after just 1 week on the job. And he now is facing the same thing, because if they get knocked out, it'll be the same as last year, round 16 and out they go. And they've injury problems and they've inconsistent form, but I suppose they do have Ronaldo and they're only one goal behind, and they have that away goal from the Porto from the first leg. So maybe the odds are in their favour tonight, but there is undoubtedly pressure on them.
Now, if Juventus have Ronaldo, then Borussia Dortmund have Erling Haaland. He is a phenomenon, an unbelievable player. Brilliant at the weekend, despite losing 4-2 to Bayern Munich, scored two goals. But then he went off on the hour mark with an injured ankle, George. Is he going to be fit tonight?
Well, that's the big question, of course, isn't it? I mean, he is the epitome of Roy of the Rovers. 19 goals in 19 Bundesliga games, 8-5 in the Champions League. So, you know, without him, they would be much less of a threat. But they are 3-2 up. They won't have Jadon Sancho tonight, the English winger. He's in a bit of trouble with an injury, so he can't play. But then Sevilla are a threat. They are a threat. 3-2 down, one goal, and then the tie becomes on its head again. And it's all a bit up in the air with the Dortmund thing. But I think, you know, Dortmund have a history. They're a strong team. Were European champions in 1997, even though they haven't been in the quarterfinals since 2017. So I think with the 3-2 from the away leg, you'd have to say that the odds are in their favour, even if Haaland doesn't make it tonight.
Okay, George, well, we will be tuned in. Two games delicately poised. That match between Juventus and Porto live on RTE. The coverage begins at 7:30. Both games kick off at 8 o'clock. Now, Sam Bennett will start today's third stage of the Paris-Nice race. It's a time trial. In third place overall, the Irish rider, fifth in yesterday's stage, the overall lead held by Michael Matthews. And finally, former Tyrone football trainer Fergal McCann has died at the age of just 47 after illness. Fergal was part of the management team which led the Tyrone footballers to All-Ireland success in 2005 and 2008. He was married, father of two children, and our thoughts and condolences are with his family and friends this morning. That's all your sport for now.
We're going to look at the policing of protests in a time of COVID. Two anti-lockdown protests in recent weeks had very different outcomes. In Dublin, a protest descended into what the Justice Minister called mindless thuggery, with 23 arrests and 3 Gardaí injured. The Cork protest passed off relatively peacefully. Now, ahead of another protest planned for Dublin on St. Patrick's Day, let's talk to Dr. Pat Leahy. He's an expert in community policing and a former Garda Commissioner, Assistant Commissioner. Dr. Leahy, good morning.
Pat, Mary. Good morning, Mary.
Hello, Pat. How are you? Now, when we leave for a moment people being beyond their 5K and this question of gathering at the moment, but when you look at what happened in Dublin on the 27th of February, do you see failures in the planning ahead, the intelligence ahead of the event and the policing on the day?
Well, it appears that there was very little intelligence, Mary, in relation to it. So, I mean, the guards that are operating in that particular division are really, really experienced at dealing with protests. I mean, they managed the Dáil continuously, and there are protests there, you know, almost every week. So these guys are really know their job. So I can only imagine that there wasn't sufficient intelligence coming in about that particular protest and who was likely to be on it and what the intent was. And I suppose it's really important, Mary, to say that the guards are probably one of the best police services in the world for engaging pre-protest with stakeholders. And they have a really, really good track record in engaging with people in advance of a protest, facilitating the protest, achieving the balance of rights that's always present when protests are taking place. And in that regard, it's unfortunate that the people that were organising this one wouldn't engage with them, and did their best to avoid any engagement or any discovery of what their intent was.
And Pat,
I think that's
that
probably
case,
what contributed to the violence.
Did the An Garda Síochána, do they have enough boots on the ground, or do they have the right boots on the ground? Do they have the public order units who work as a team in managing these types of protests?
Well, I think what would give me some cause for concern, Mary, is that when you see reports of the guards having to go across the city looking for reinforcements to come in, would indicate that there were insufficient resources there at the time. Now, one of the big problems with bringing people in that context is you have to nominate a rendezvous point because they have to be briefed. You can't have people arriving in patrol cars. We saw that in the May Day riots in the past, where people come in, they're not briefed appropriately, they don't know the context, they don't know who's in charge. All of that has to be pre-planned if you're going to be bringing people in from around the divisions in the city like that. But the public order unit were present, but they were there in soft caps. So they weren't wearing helmets and shields. And that probably was the decision that was made in order to prevent provoking a response from the people that were attending the protest. And I suppose the guards are kind of caught between a rock and a hard place, Mary, because they've been through this throughout the pandemic. And while there was engagement, with use of force, I suppose, on a number of occasions beforehand, it was all low level. And indeed, when you compare this, what happened in Grafton Street, to what's going on across Europe, it's low level as well, albeit that it was violent and people were injured at it. Compared to what happens across mainland Europe, it is low level.
And another protest on St. Patrick's Day, will we see a different style of approach, do you think?
Well, I imagine that if they're cut out resource-wise for St. Patrick's Day, then there's no excuse to it, that's for sure, because, I mean, the indicators are that there is going to be a protest. We know what type of people are likely to turn up. I mean, that was one of the benefits for the guards in Cork, really, is that they had seen what had happened a week before, so they knew that there was intent there, so they were in a position to release the resources that are required. Because, I mean, look, policing protest is a costly business. And when you get through it time and time again, and you don't end up with a Grafton Street scenario, people tend to reduce the resources potentially, and you can find yourself being cut out. Now, in Cork, they were ready for it. I'd say there was no, based on what I'm reading and what I'm hearing, is there was no lack of resources available for it. However, in Dublin, it appeared as there were some resources that should have been there or could have been there that weren't there.
All right, a final
and,
quick question.
Whether that was policy or what, I'm not sure. But all I can say is that the people that were responsible for the protest on the ground are really, really experienced people, and they've been through this many
Pat,
times.
Just finally, very briefly, were they right to close off St. Stephen's Green?
Yes, look, I've heard people suggest that we should be stopping these people around the city before they get there at all. The problem with that, Mary, is that you're spreading your resources or what resources you have across multiple sites.
Okay.
And with the help now of social media, the people that are organising these protests can move their supporters around very, very quickly.
All right.
And you find yourself then operating on several fronts, which is not good practice.
Okay.
You're much better off when it's going to happen and you know it's going to happen. You're better off knowing where they're all going to be, so
all
you
right.
can put a proper plan in place and you can use a graduated response then in dealing with them, because you have to assume in advance that not all the people arriving are intent on using violence against an Garda Síochána. In actual fact, it's generally speaking, it's a very small minority that are you know, intent on doing this.
Okay,
and you have
past,
to facilitate
there we must
the other
it.
People that are arriving in terms of protecting them. Now, obviously,
there we must leave it, Pat. Apologies. I think we have a problem with our sound crossing each other there. That's Dr. Pat Leahy, former Garda Assistant Commissioner at 9 minutes to 9.
Now, more of us are in our gardens if we're lucky enough to have them. We're growing things, tending and enjoying the outdoors. New figures from Bord Bia show that there's been a 50% rise in spending on our gardens in the 2 years to 2020. Last year, we spent €1.2 billion on gardening. Well, our reporter Elise Sheehy has been speaking to people at the Cope House allotments in Drogheda.
Landscaper Derek Hackett has had an allotment in Cope for a number of years, but last year, during the first lockdown, he invested in a polytunnel, a new project which is keeping him on his toes.
This is the polytunnel. I'll just show you inside here. So if you want to have a look inside there. This one I started last year. It was April lockdown. I live in the apartment block across the way, so this became a lifeline for me to actually get out and about. Not to have this would have been very hard, really, really difficult. It's gotten me through both lockdowns now at this stage. For me, it's more about the ornamentals. So you'll see narcissus in here, tulips. I've got crinodoxia, all these bulbs for seasonal planting. I'm a landscaper myself, so this actually works out nicely that you can grow on your seasonal bulbs and be able to plant them out when you want, rather than having to wait until the season arrives to actually be going back to doing jobs. So everybody's been looking to get their gardening done. You could definitely see it down here in the allotment, the amount of people actually out.
So I'm just raking here at the moment, and we're getting the beds. There are a couple of raised beds here ready for when we have some seeds that will be a little bit bigger in the next kind of 6 weeks or so that we can get into the ground.
In a nearby plot, Linda Blake is making the best out of the dry weather. After spending a lot of time in her garden last year, she decided to rent a plot at the local allotment in Cope in January. A new pastime and a welcome change of scene for Linda, her husband and their two children.
We've grown some stuff at home in the garden over the last few years, and we kind of decided, particularly after last summer when we couldn't go anywhere and we spent so much more time in the garden than outside, that maybe if we had a bigger space we could grow more and just have somewhere to go that is close to home, because with the uncertainty of everything we didn't know how much things would actually change, especially with having the two small children and the fact that it is within 5k of our house, which we are really lucky to have something like this here. Even on a Sunday morning, come down and you can potter around and do a bit and have your morning coffee here. So far this year we've mostly bought some soil for the ground just to top up the beds. We've used slabs from home to put in a few stepping stones and some seeds.
You'll be taking your first earlys in June.
Okay, grand.
Probably through to July, August. And then winter cabbages will go into it, you know.
For Christmas.
Yeah, but you're going to have the sage, the mint, garlic chives, the coriander and cress.
Where are we putting the salads then that we're going to use?
We're using the first three rows for those.
Father and daughter, Michael and Denise Walsh, are gearing up for a busy summer. Michael, who has recently retired, is helping Denise grow produce that she hopes to use in her three local cafes, a new venture they are really enjoying.
I own cafes called Relish and Mint Green in the Drogheda area, and we have a family allotment here where we took up last year during lockdown, and when the cafes were closed, it was something that I always aspired to do. So now we're hoping this year to be able to supply salads, vegetables, soup mixes, that kind of thing that we'd be able to use in the cafes. My dad retired last year, and it was an idea that we came up with, and we actually had to wait for an allotment. There wasn't any available.
It means that I'm busier now than I ever was when I was working. It's wonderful. I'm very lucky in the sense that I don't live too far away from here. 5 minute walk and has me down here. When the golf courses are open, it's a toss up between here and the golf course. Yeah, it's fun. It's really good fun.
That sounds great, and good luck to them. Sounds tasty as well. Michael and Denise Walsh, ending that report by Elise Sheehy. It's 4 minutes to 9.
And finally this morning to Brian Mooney, guidance counsellor and Irish Times columnist, on this news that over 79,000 applications for third level courses have been received by the CAO. That's an increase of over 6,000 applicants. Brian, to what do you attribute this increase, which is fairly significant?
three factors. 2,700 additional student applicants from European universities, European countries, basically those who would have gone to the UK previously, they're now priced out of the UK market as international students. They're hoping to come here. An extra 1,454 students who have applied as matures, that is over 23 years of age. Those are probably people who had jobs, lost them through COVID, and effectively are wondering whether they're ever going to come back. And there's a demographic increase that's going to go through second level over the next 5 to 6 years that has been through primary, and those students are adding to the number. So those three together add about 7,000 to the Level 8 application numbers from last year.
And Brian, as you look through the choices that are being made, could you say that there is perhaps a COVID impact on the choices that students are making?
Well, there is in the sense that science is up hugely, and I mean science and all of the medical and paramedical. Medical itself is up to, medicine is up 25%. Nursing is up, all of the other dentistry, veterinary, all of those are up. Arts and social science are also, which is also interesting. And if you look at the other areas, they're actually effectively down, given that you have an 11% increase in applications at Level 8. So really, there is a COVID effect in terms of people's awareness of science and heightened awareness of all of the medical and paramedical areas, including nursing.
I know the Minister has a task force looking at the numbers in universities and colleges, but can we accommodate the numbers that want to go on to third level?
Well, there's a bit of a pinch point this year. Obviously, there are 600 people who got offers that has to come out of this year's cohort, in a sense. They were people who did the Leaving Cert in October, November. They're starting now in next September in new courses. That's 600 gone immediately. Minister was on with Clare yesterday, and he was talking about creating 4,000 additional places. The problem is, will they be at the pinch points? Because a lot of the places that we need to create also have placements, as in medical placements, dentistry placements, etc., and nursing placements. If you can't create the placements, you can't create the places. Mm-hmm. So it's not a question of overall numbers, it's creating numbers in the areas where students
all
actually
right.
want
we're at a pinch point now. We've got to go. Brian Mooney, thank you very much. A Minute to Nine.